Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte. This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles, just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
We got Dee Snider on the show today. Holy shit. It's going to be great. Anyways, let's do this. I want to thank everyone who joins me on Patreon. You guys are just awesome. You do so much for me. Not only is it a financial thing that you're supporting me with, it's an emotional thing. We have 34 of you now, and Victor works hard doing a lot of posts on the page. I try to get some posts up to you guys. And yeah, I know I haven't done a video in a while. I'm going to do that for some of you upper tier people. And I just want to say thank you. Thank you to everyone on Patreon, patreon.com/talkingmetal. That's where we go to support people like Metal Dan, support us there. Jeremy Weltman, Chris Riley, Johan Enderstrom, Steven Rodriguez, Tommy Anderson, Adam Marr, Gregory, Kenny McCrimmon, Leo from Alaska, Brad Dahl, Richard Langridge, Dan Gruen, Patrick Schwartzman, Jerry from Long Island, Sam Soupy, Drake, Matt Carroll, Joe Ryan, Joe Urock, the man who really got the Talking Metal masks going, which are now available if you want to buy one. $18 for people in the States. Jason Seth, Steven Saylor, Ron Keel, Jean-Francois Blas, Anthony Mackey, James Bennett, Mr. David Gray, Fred Rutz, Michael Street, Jay Vaninsky, Mike Jones, the Greyhound dad, Steve Hoker, Jean Beauvoir. Thank you, guys. Dee Snider is here. I can't freaking believe it.
Hi, I'm Mark Striegel, host and producer of this show since 2005. On this episode, we're going to talk some rock, some metal, and anything else we feel like. We're also going to jam some tunes, have a drink, and share some honest opinions. Thanks for listening to the Talking Metal Podcast. Let's get things started. This is the Sean Baker Orchestra with Which Way to Radioland. We'll be right back.
sitting out here on my patio. It is a beautiful day in July here in New Jersey. Things starting to open back up. I was so proud of our state of New Jersey. One out of two states, Rhode Island and New Jersey, where cases were actually going down instead of holding steady or shooting way up. So, you know, we got hit first here. Or not first, but yeah, pretty much first, you know. Westchester up in New York State, right across the state line there. But yeah, I'm so proud of New Jersey, and I'm so happy that we are opening back up. The governor has said we can now have gatherings of up to 500 people with face coverings. I can't help but think concerts are going to be returning here. Fingers crossed. I'm optimistic. Let's hope so. Dee Snider. Holy shit. We got Dee Snider on the podcast today. I cannot believe it. It is an absolute honor to speak with this guy. Let's do this right now. This is The Fire Still Burns by Twisted Sister from 1985. Man, great tune. We'll hear that, and then we're going to hear from Dee Snider, and we're going to end the show with a song called Prove Me Wrong. It is the new studio cut off of the new live record. The whole album is live except this one studio cut, and you can buy this before the release of the album, which I believe is July 31st. This song is now up on Apple Music and Spotify and stuff, Amazon Music. So go purchase it, support Dee, and let's do this. A true honor to speak with a guy I've been a fan of for, man, a long freaking time. Like 40, not quite 40 years, but 36, 37 years. Wow, I'm old. Here we go. The Fire Still Burns by Twisted Sister. And then after the interview, Prove Me Wrong by Dee Snider, a new studio cut. Mark Striegel of Talking Metal, and what an honor, a guy I've been trying to get on the show for so long, Dee Snider. Dee, how are you, man?
I'm good, and I hear that too often, and I'm sorry that I've been so difficult. I just, so many people start out with, I've been trying to get in. I'm like, oh boy, am I really that unaccessible? So my apologies.
No worries. I'm so glad you're here talking with us. I've been a longtime fan, going way back to the first time I saw you live with Iron Maiden back in the day on the World Slavery Tour.
Dang, when men were men and tours were tours, that was, to me, the ultimate metal tour. It was right before it went, all of a sudden we had this, it became hair metal.
Right.
You know, up to that point, it was just metal. And you could have an Iron Maiden and a Twisted Sister on the same stage. You could have Motorhead and Twisted Sister on the same stage. And people just said, okay, you know, that Metallica, we toured with Metallica. They opened for Twisted. And nobody thought, oh, what are those two bands doing here together? It was just metal. We were a weird metal band that wore makeup, and they were a metal band that didn't wear. You know what I mean? So that was a great tour.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you about everything that's going on now, but I will say one of my most vivid concert memories, and I've been to hundreds of concerts, was that show at, I believe, the Mecca Arena in Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It was one of the few times an opening band had everyone there. I mean, every seat in the arena taken.
I was going to say that it was not an opening band situation. It was filled from 7 o'clock. I don't remember there being an empty seat in the house. Like, people that we want to see Iron Maiden and we want to see Twisted Sister. And I don't remember like, you know, like I remember we toured with Alice Cooper and the whole front section of the arena being empty as the Alice. This was when we reunited, the Alice Cooper hardcore showing up fashionably late, you know, and that feeling of being like being an opening band again. Didn't have that feeling at all with Maiden. It was just an event.
Yeah. And it certainly was. It was, I think, my third concert that I ever went to. And you came out, not only was every seat in the arena filled, everyone was standing. And I remember vividly, there was one guy who wouldn't get out of his seat. And about three songs in, you spotted him and started pointing him out to everyone, and the whole arena was yelling at the guy to stand up, and he didn't. But it was just a great moment. So much fun.
Yeah, it was great until the time I did it to a whole section of people and who weren't standing. And I threw the show away to get this section on their feet. They would not stand up. I put spotlights on them. I had the crowd chanting, stand up, stand up. I had the crowd singing, chanting, F you, F you. They would not stand up. I stormed off the stage at the dressing room. I was so angry that I couldn't get these a-holes to stand up. And my manager came through the door and said, what the hell are you doing? And I said, what? He goes, screaming at those people. I said, they wouldn't stand up. He said, it was the handicap section.
Oh, no. That's funny. That's great.
So
stuff.
From that day on, I would be handed every night, I'd be handed a map and say, and this is where the handicap people are.
Don't yell at them.
Do not yell at them. And I was like, oh my God, I was so embarrassed. I got those poor people. I'm brutalizing, cursing at them, screaming at them. You know how I get.
Yeah.
And they couldn't stand. Believe me, I'm sure they would have stood up if they could.
Right on. And I've seen you so many times during the years, and it's always just a pleasure to see you perform live. And speaking of performing live, you have a new live album on the way. July 31st, we'll see For the Love of Metal Live released, an album, a DVD, Blu-ray. So this is recorded in different places, Dee?
Yeah, unlike most live records and certainly the ones I've done in the past, which have been sort of one, you know, one arena, one festival, one concert hall, and, you know, sort of a one night experience. We filmed multiple shows, and it's a compilation of about 9 different shows. And what's unique about the DVD is that in one, not just one song, in one line of a song, it cuts from country to country, day to night, sun to rain, in one line of a song. And when I suggested this idea, people were concerned it wouldn't work. It does. And the purpose of that was, I was trying to show the community that how connected we all are and how the music connects us, no matter if we are in Sweden or Brazil or Australia or England or the United States. everybody, metal is metal is metal, and that love is shared, hence For the Love of Metal Live. So it's a unique approach to a live concert, but I think it's very effective.
Yeah, absolutely. And we get some new songs by Dee Snider on the record. There's actually a new studio track too. Let's start there. Prove Me Wrong. Is that something you recorded for the original studio version of For the Love of Metal that you had left over, or was it a new song you went into the studio to record?
I'm glad you asked that, because the Napalm, my label, wanted a bonus track. Everybody's trying to load these things up with some reason for people to buy the product. And they said, do you have any outtakes from For the Love of Metal? We did not. And I said, but we can go and write something and record something. And they were like, oh, that would be really cool. So the beginning of this year, me and Charlie Belmore, my guitar player, wrote Prove Me Wrong, and we recorded it with the band, and it's on the record. And it's important, a message I'm sending to people, and I hope I want them to know this. This is Dee Snider for this millennium. Right. This is what you could expect from me moving forward.
It's a great tune, man.
For the Love of Metal was me rediscovering, finding my voice, finding my place in the community, and I am staying on the course and staying on this path. So Prove Me Wrong sounds like it could be an outtake from For the Love of Metal, because that is who I am, what I am, and where I am going. So that's why the track is, I'm glad it's on there.
Absolutely. And you say where you're going, I assume that means there will be more studio music down the road.
The intention is for that. Now there's a but coming up, and my father always says everything after the word but is BS. So it's not BS though, but I have always been involved in a great many things, as you know, radio, TV, movies, things like that, acting, producing, and now I'm getting into directing. I was supposed to be directing my first feature film, My Enemy's Enemy, in May, and that's been pushed back due to COVID. So that is my next project. Then I've been approached, and I'm currently developing, to rewrite and direct reimagine a classic 80s slasher film. And so I've been working on that. And that's supposed to be after I do My Enemy's Enemy, then I'm supposed to go and start filming that one. Movies take time. And that is what I really wanted. And I just wrote my first fictional novel, which is out at publishers right now. So I know that it'll get published and released, and I'll be promoting that. So on my immediate horizon, I see directing two movies, and I see releasing my first fictional novel. After that, my brain says music. But I don't, with COVID, with what's going on, I don't know exactly when that's going to be.
Right.
So the plan is there in my brain, but I've got a number of things between then and now.
Awesome. Cool. And I do want to talk to you about some of the film stuff and the book that you mentioned, but just to kind of circle back to the new live record, For the Love of Metal Live, again, out July 31st by Dee Snider. A great AC/DC cover will be on the record too, Highway to Hell. And you've had such an incredible career. I wanted to ask you, I know you're a big AC/DC fan. Have you ever had any run-ins with those guys? Have you hung out with those guys ever?
Yeah, AC/DC is one of my major influences, sort of the final influence. You know, I go back to Zeppelin and Dio and Priest and you know, Alice Cooper and glitter rock of the early 70s. And AC/DC came around in the late 70s when I discovered them early on, and had amazing effect. They showed me that four chords is still can make a great song. And Bon Scott's voice was the last piece in defining what Dee Snider's voice. You hear that nasal thing in my voice? That's
right.
Bon. Live and eat that! You know, right. Okay, I like that. I want to put some nasalness in my voice. So, finding my place. So to honor them and to play an AC/DC song on the record, on the live album, I love doing it live. The audience loves it. And to me, it's honoring them as well. As far as over the years, I became friends with Brian Johnson, who's a great guy, and he's one of the most amiable guys in the world. So there's a great many people who say, oh, I'm friends with Brian Johnson, because he's friends with everybody.
Right.
But he's a great guy. I've only got to meet the rest of the band once. And for me, meeting Angus Young was truly meeting one of my greatest heroes. And and I've met, met and become friends with Alice. I've met and become friends with Robert Plant. And these are guys with my, posters over my bed guys, But Angus, for some reason, I was really kind of nervous about meeting him. And when I walked in the room and saw how little he was and how big I was, I felt very awkward. I wanted to tell him how much he meant to me. And yet, towering over him, and as I saw him and we were approaching each other, I said, it just didn't feel right. I should be looking up to Angus Young, not looking right down at Angus Young. Yeah. So just at the moment, I'm just up to him. Out of the corner of my eye, we're in a dressing room, I see a folding chair. And I grabbed it and I slide it over real quick and like put my foot on it and brought myself down to his eye level.
Yeah, that's great.
And it was instantaneous. Like, hey, man, your music just, and I said, oh, this is much better. Because I'm looking him eye to eye, and I just wanted to make that contact with him. And he was very nice. But I have a feeling that I'm one of thousands who have said those exact words to him. Dude, you changed my life.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's a great story, D. And 35 years ago, you guys released. When I say you guys, Twisted Sister, Come Out and Play. How do you look back on that record now, 35 years later?
Come Out and Play was my master stroke. Let me clarify. I mean, I finally had free reign. I finally had an unlimited budget. And I finally could do the things I wanted to do musically. I had this time in the studio. Every other record had a clock ticking, with the album artwork, with the stage show, with the merch. Everything with the videos, everything was conceptualized, connected, and again, I just could have had free reign. Unfortunately, there was the timing of the record, the release, the first single release, Mistake on Me. I didn't read the community and the way I was so full of myself, and I'll take full blame. I was just a megalomaniac. And by look up the word that whatever you read, that's me. I looked it up. I said, oh yeah, that was me. I was so on such a power trip of the high of being rich, famous, and successful that I completely misread, that the community's view of Twisted Sister and how it needed a correction. Like we had crossed over. And the core audience had started to question our validity and our dedication to the metal community. And I completely didn't see that, and just went charging full steam ahead, continuing down the path of, of rock radio, top 40 charts and all that bullcrap. I'm trying not to curse because I think you do a radio show.
Wait, so it's okay.
Oh, it's okay. Yeah. So the record ultimately, was a failure. Europe did really well. America went gold, but it was considered a failure. It was damaging to the band because I was such an authoritarian dictator on the record. I didn't allow anybody to have a voice or an opinion. And it ultimately led to the breakup of the group. And killed the goose that laid the golden egg. Just a little asterisk on this, learning a valuable lesson way too late. I counseled Skid Row on their follow-up album to the first Skid Row album. And I'm thanked in the thank yous on that record. The relationship between Sebastian and the band was rocky, and I sort of counseled Sebastian through that. But I also told the band, I said, listen, make no mistake. Your last single was I Remember You. People are questioning whether you're really a metal band or you're a pop band. You're in all the teen magazines. You need to come back hard. And so they released Monkey Business, followed by Slave to the Grind,
right.
and just cemented, said that, and sent that message, which Twisted needed to send. And I would say, oh, no, no, we're metal, man. Don't judge us by the last power ballad. But unfortunately, nobody gave me that advice. I probably wouldn't have listened anyway.
Right on. For me, though, personally, I there was some great tunes off of the, you know, Come Out and Play album, including the title track, which was extremely heavy, which kicked that whole
The Fire Still Burns. With the live album, I meld the new music and old music, and I wanted to show the connection because Twisted was a metal band, and choosing the more metallic songs from our catalog, like Under the Blade, Fire Still Burns, Burn in Hell, Can't Stop Rock and Roll, and adding in the detuning and my great band, adding a few little more, here and there, it really all works together. You kind of go, oh, wow, this is a body of music here, and it all connects. So, the metal was definitely there. I just, completely miscalled the first single and misread the public. I take complete blame. I was driving.
Right on.
Driving.
Right on. So you mentioned a movie, My Enemy's Enemy. Of course, you gave us Strangeland way back. What was that? 98, I believe. So this is how would you compare your new movie to that?
Well, on the darkness level, it is brutally disturbing. And as I reinvented the horror wheel with Strangeland, and for those in doubt, it is the first film rated R for scenes of torture.
Wow. Okay.
I used to host a horror radio show called Fangoria Radio, and Eli Roth and John, the guy who did forget his last name, the director of Saw. They bowed down before me for my inspiration as far as creating movies that weren't about death, were more about suffering. And and writing My Enemy's Enemy, I didn't want to do another horror film until I came up with an idea that was equally original and equally game changing and would definitely, well, I was going to say raise the bar, but I think I lowered it. I had to think of, matter of fact, I dug a hole in the ground and dropped the bar in. My Enemy's Enemy will redefine horror. It'll be a new genre of horror.
Wow.
And it's based on an actual event that happened on Long Island in 1982, a crime that was committed that the people who committed it received 365 years consecutive each.
Wow.
Considered the worst crime in the history of Long Island. But I took that and threw an X Factor curveball in it, a what if scenario, which takes it down from an action thriller, turns it into a horror movie about midpoint. So it's unique, and I look forward to my first, not as making the movie, but my first time behind the camera as director, which I'm excited about.
And do you think you'll get in front of the camera for it too?
No, for multiple reasons. I'm really trying to get out of the performing part of things. I'm so limited by my age, physicality, skin color, all those things. And what I love about writing is that I can be anybody. As long as the word on the page is convincing and an actor or actress can portray the part, no one cares that Quentin Tarantino isn't black. As Samuel L. Jackson says, he writes really well for black guys.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's a freedom you have as a writer, which I really enjoy. So I'm much happier to just be, in the writer, director chair than in the actor chair.
And you mentioned you also might be involved with remaking or rewriting a cult classic. I wanted to ask you a number of years back, I guess it was back in 2007, Rob Zombie redid Halloween. Did you see his version of it? And what did you think?
He did multiple ones, right? Halloween. First one I really liked. Second, I believe he did two.
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah,
I know two. He did a bunch of movies, but I'm not sure about that yet.
As a matter of fact, Malik Akkad, the producer of the Halloween franchise, is producing the reimagining of the 80s slasher film that it's not Halloween, but right, he's okay. Producing the movie with me. And I think Rob's incredible. You know, one thing he did with Michael Myers, which was a mistake. And I don't know if he would see it that way, but I will certainly not do that. He tried to make you feel for Michael, try to explain how he was an abused child and he had this thing with masks and he was hiding. And we don't want to know that about these killers.
Right.
That
right.
It's not the nature of Jason Voorhees to have had to be a poor, you know, to be an abused child. We don't care. It's we just want them to be a machine, you know. So that, you know, he did a great job visualizing and stuff, but I believe that was in the second one that just was not, you know, that he crossed the line for me. And I'm a horror aficionado. And as I said, I applaud his work. He's done some tremendous horror films, and he's a great, talented artist. Nobody gets it right all the time. Hence, Come Out and Play. You know, a great album, but I made a fatal mistake with the first single. Unfortunately, we have to live with those mistakes, though.
Right on. And real quick, before I let you go, Dee, you've had an incredible career, obviously the music, but set the music aside and the acting, the directing of films, books, radio, what career highlights or highlight rises to the top of the non-musical career that you've had?
I'm performing on Broadway in Rock of Ages for 3 months.
Right on.
Wow. You know, the lesson, if I could share a lesson with people, they always ask me, how do you do all these things? Well, there's a lot bigger explanation to what brought me to taking all these challenges. But one of the big things I learned was say yes and figure it out later. And now that doesn't mean fake it till you make it. That means say yes. And if the opportunity arises, get in there and do the work to figure out how to do it. And I was at the premiere of Rock of Ages on Broadway, and one of the producers came up to me and said, what would you think about being in the show? And I said, sure. 2 years later, I was on a safari with my family in the jungles of Africa, and a satellite phone rings, it's your manager. And I get on the phone, and I was like, Phil, are you kidding me? This has been my wife's dream. We've been waiting to do this trip, the whole family, and you're calling me now, and he says, you're in. I said, in wow. What? He says, Rock of Ages. Now, my wife, now we weren't expecting to get a call. My wife says, my face, she thought somebody died by the look on my face. The next word I said was, when? Now, I was meaning, when am I in? She thought I meant, when did they die?
Right.
And
right.
He said, when you get land next week, you go into rehearsals the next day. 2 weeks after that, you're on Broadway, starring in the show. And I hung up. My wife said, who died? I said, no one died. I'm in Rock of Ages. And I'd never done anything like that since, other than like a high school play or something, you know. I said yes. I went in there. I worked my ass off. And I learned how to do it all. And it's much bigger deal than one would think. Singing, dancing, acting, even the backstage choreography, moving around, costume changes, and all that craziness, and I like to think I did it well. People who saw me, applauded and enjoyed it, and I'm proud of that time. But it really was such a different experience and a major achievement for me as an artist to do something out of my comfort zone, completely out of my comfort zone, and to conquer it and do it well.
That's great. And I like that. We'll end with that phrase that you just said. What was it? Say yes and figure it out later. Is that what
you said? Figure it out later. Remember, that's not fake it till you make it.
Right.
That's okay. They said yes. I got the gig. Now I got to really figure out how to do this and make it work. So go get them, everybody. Great talking to you finally.
Yes.
Hopefully it's not so long between chats next time.
Perfect. Dee, it's an honor. Thank you. Good luck to you.
Pleasure, man. Take care.
Bye-bye.